of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Questions the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Clear all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, March 28th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A bittersweet victory for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Janitors across California exercise their bargaining power as contract negotiations heat up, and an annual survey of homeless women in downtown LA reveal their ongoing struggle for survival.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A three-judge panel with the Third Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Philadelphia refused to reinstate the death penalty for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal yesterday. While this is a major victory for Abu-Jamal and his supporters, his murder conviction in the 1981 shooting death of police officer Daniel Faulkner was left intact. The state now has 6 months to hold a new sentencing hearing for Abu-Jamal. If a new hearing is not held, the life imprisonment sentence stands. The legal appeal was based on the argument that racism by the judge and prosecutors in the original trial played a negative role in Abu-Jamal's conviction by a nearly all-white jury. Abu-Jamal's lawyers were hoping for an entirely new trial to prove his innocence. In the lengthy opinions issued yesterday, one of the three judges, Judge Thomas L. Ambrose, wrote that he would have gone further than his two colleagues in granting a hearing on Abu-Jamal's contention that the prosecution unfairly excluded blacks from his jury. Recently, in a story we covered this week on Uprising, an African-American man from Louisiana named Alan Snyder was granted a new trial after the U.S. Supreme Court decided that black jurors had been excluded from his jury on the basis of their race. My guest is Robert R. Bryan. He is the lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal, joining us live from San Francisco. Welcome to Uprising, Robert.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. So how do you react to what happened yesterday? On the one hand, certainly that the death penalty is off the table, at least until a new hearing may be held. Is that a good thing?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a mixed bag what happened yesterday. Mumia, I might point out, is still on death row. He's been incarcerated for 27 years now, on death row for 26 years, and that's where he is this morning. We certainly expect the state to the district attorney's office to seek review of this hearing. So Mumia certainly will remain on death row at least for the time being. As one who specializes in defending people facing the death penalty, I've handled a very large number of these cases over the past 30 years. Anytime the death penalty is thrown out, it's a victory. So in that sense, this was a great victory. Mumia and I had two legal conferences yesterday, and he's very pleased with this ruling. However, and this is the mixed part, on the negative side, we wanted more, and we do expect more than just a new jury trial on the question of the death penalty or whether the sentence should be life. We want an entirely new trial. I want this case back before a jury, and I won't, as I've done in many other cases, my client acquitted so he can go home to his family. So in that sense, that's the negative. However, as you pointed out in your introduction, the decision denying a completely new trial was split. We had a three-judge U.S. Court of Appeals panel. Two voted against us, but one wrote a 41-page opinion strongly arguing that racism was a major factor in jury selection in this case, that people were removed because of their race, and thus we should be granted relief. And I will say that with my extensive experience in death penalty litigation, I've never seen such a strong dissenting opinion.
Robert, in going through the opinions issued yesterday, not just the dissenting ones, but all of them, it seems as though the contention of racism in jury selection was thrown out, at least by the other two judges, because Abu Jamal did not raise the issue when those jurors were taken off the jury, and that because he didn't raise it at that time, that somehow there is no prima facie case. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. The law that's controlling on this was based upon a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1986, and the name of the case was Batson versus Kentucky. So that case had not even been decided in 1981, the time of the 1982 trial.
And that Batson versus Kentucky is the case where it was established that if people are removed on the basis of their race, that is unconstitutional.
Yes, and I presented a new case. You mentioned Snyder versus Louisiana, decided March 19, just last week, to the court, which was cited by this dissenting judge, in which the U.S. Supreme Court and one of its new Bush appointees, Alito, wrote the majority opinion reaffirming very strongly that even removing one prospective person, a juror, because of his or her race was constitutionally unacceptable and mandated a completely new trial. So the law is very strong in this regard. What's troubling about this is that this lack of objection, what they refer to as contemporaneous objection at the time of jury selection by this very overwhelmed defense attorney at the time of trial, appointed lawyer, the law did not require him to do that. And in no other case by either the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which is in Philadelphia, or the Supreme Court has required, had this contemporaneous objection requirement in such matters. Now, in other words, the court cuts to the chase and says, if racism is a basis for somebody being removed, that's totally unacceptable, and a new trial must be granted. End of story.
Now, weren't they trying to come up with some sort of statistical evidence that there was no racism by looking at percentages of blacks removed?
And well, they did. They tried to, but the dissenting judge pointed out a couple of things. Number one, that nearly 70% of the strikes to remove prospective people, jurors, from being on the jury by the prosecution, nearly 70%, were employed against people who were African-American in the first place. And secondly, this judge pointed out that it does not require very much. It's a very low bar to get over in order to establish a prima facie case of racism in jury selection. He said certainly that was accomplished, you know, achieved in this case. So we're disappointed over that part of the ruling, but we're very encouraged by this dissent because it will be a roadmap, a light in the darkness as to where we go at this point in seeking a total reversal.
My guest is Robert R. Bryan, lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're discussing the Court of Appeals decision yesterday that essentially has not granted a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal, although it refused to reinstate the death penalty.
Well, that's not exactly right. Mm-hmm. The death penalty is still there. It's not being reinstated. Mumia
but this particular court did not reinstate the death penalty.
No, well, the death penalty was still there. What the court did is threw out the death penalty because of the way it was imposed in this case. Mumia has remained on death row. There was a favorable federal court decision in December 2001, but the state, the district attorney of Philadelphia, immediately appealed, which resulted in that having no effect. So the death penalty still remained on Mumia Abu-Jamal. He continues to be on death row. So what the court did is actually threw out the death penalty.
So
we do expect the state to appeal that, the prosecution to appeal that, just as we're going to be appealing.
Right, and so they have 6 months to do just that.
Well, they have 6 months to either go back before a new jury for a new penalty trial in which the issue will be life or death. That's what the court said. Now, I will say that this dissenting opinion as I said, is like a light in the darkness for us. It's so powerful. We will be seeking a very quickly a hearing before the entire court, not just three judges, but the entire all the judges in the court, because of this very strong dissenting opinion. If that's denied, and I think the likelihood of success is pretty high looking at this dissenting opinion, we would certainly go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I expect the prosecution to do likewise on the death penalty being thrown out in the case.
What about the remarks made at one point by one of the judges in Mumia's case, Judge Sabo? Was his racism discussed and decided upon?
One of our issues in the case was the bias and racism of the trial judge.
Mm-hmm.
And we have discovered from a court stenographer that during a recess of the 1982 trial, he was, this Judge Sabo, the trial judge, was overheard saying, I'm going to help them fry the, and you refer to Mumia Abu-Jamal using the N-word, I'm going to help them fry the N-word. And I don't know if it's appropriate to use that on the radio, even though it's a quote from the judge. I mean, this judge was a real dyed-in-the-wool racist. I used to try many murder cases, capital cases in the South. I thought I had seen a lot of racism, but nothing of the level of, in this case. The problem we have with that one issue, which the court picked up on, unfortunately, in this decision, is that the lawyers before me, before I took over the case, made a big mistake. They attacked the judge's racism at a hearing 13 years after the trial, but did not accuse him of being biased at the time of the trial. It was just a stupid mistake, but we're saddled with that. Even though Mumia first approached me 22 years ago to represent him, and I did not have time then because of a very busy murder case caseload, I feel kind of badly. I wish I had taken it because I had had the time, because that's just a mistake that just we all make mistakes, but it's just kind of unimaginable how somebody could flub up like that, but it happens. So.
And so because it was not raised at that time, the Federal Court of Appeals yesterday, U.S. Court of Appeals yesterday, did not take that accusation seriously.
Right, but the reality still is that this whole case from the beginning, a thread running through it through today, is racism. The District Attorney's Office in Philadelphia is documented in case after case, both before and after Mumia Abu-Jamal's 1982 trial, of being very racist in the way it dealt with jury selection and various other aspects of a trial. There was one other issue in the case which the court rejected, and we will be seeking relief on this one too, and that is a prosecutor at the guilt phase essentially lied to the jury and gave the jury the impression there would be other trials. So if they made a mistake, they should lean towards erring on the side of conviction rather than innocence, which is turning the presumption of innocence, that constitutional right, on its head. That's a big issue. So there's a lot in the mix here, and a lot we will be doing. We lost partially a battle yesterday, but the war is far from over.
And you mentioned earlier that you would be willing to take this all the way to the Supreme Court.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and I will not rest. I can tell you I will not rest until we get a new, entirely new trial, not just a new penalty jury trial, my client is acquitted. I mean, he is not guilty of murder. My investigation and the facts just seem pretty overwhelming, and I've had a lot of acquittals in cases with much less evidence in that regard than in this case.
And do you think on that point that, of course, the very, very high profile of this case and its absolute politicization, of course, plays a role with heavy lobbying and pressure by the Fraternal Order of Police, and also Maureen Faulkner and her allies, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, all of that plays a role in this case?
Absolutely, and there's no question that that had an effect yesterday. The dissenting judge, interestingly, raised the question of why the majority did not follow precedent, why they carved out an exception only in this case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And he raised that twice. Why are they not following the law. There's no contemporaneous objection requirement. If racism was involved in removing people, keeping people from the jury, that offends the U.S. Constitution, and a new trial is mandated. Mm-hmm. So he was puzzled why they seemed to veer, or they didn't seem, why they did not follow established law, not only in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, but established decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're in very sound footing.
Well, Robert, Brian, finally, how you said you had two meetings with Mumia Abu-Jamal yesterday. What are his spirits like?
Well, he was happy and sad. He was happy about the death penalty being thrown out, even though he remains on death row as of today. But he was disappointed that we did not get a complete reversal. It's tough. I was sitting in my office looking. I can look out my window at the Golden Gate Bridge, and he's sitting in a small, dank cell on Pennsylvania's death row, like thousands of others in this country are sitting on death rows. But, you know, they can't lock up the mind, and he's written five extraordinary books from death row, continues to do weekly commentaries on human rights issues, and so as he said at the end, he said, the struggle will continue. We will persevere.
Robert Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Robert R. Brian is the lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and of course, you often hear Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries on Uprising. You can also hear them online at prisonradio.org. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll be joined in studio by a couple of women with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition, and we'll also hear this radical day in history, and janitors across California are demanding their rights. They're continuing to organize for a better contract, and about 1,000 of them will be demonstrating in Westwood this afternoon. We'll hear from them after this week's Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about race in America.
In the next weeks and months, you're going to hear a great deal from Black Agenda Report and Black Agenda Radio about the various proposals for some kind of dialogue on race in the United States. Let me make it clear from the very beginning, we at BAR are not interested in any kind of verbal duel with liars. There are facts and there are lies. The most important fact relating to the history of the United States is that it was created in a centuries-long project of human extermination and replacement of those murdered Native American millions by millions of Africans who were then classified as beasts whose only reason for living was to serve the every whim of the white winners of those two continental race wars. Now, that, of course, is the truth that is celebrated as a kind of white national religion. The general belief is that God was in favor of killing 19 out of every 20 or so Native Americans to make way for Europeans to steal two continents, and that God also favored the kidnapping of millions of Africans in order to make the European Americans extraordinarily rich. This white American God likes his people to be rich and doesn't much care how they go about becoming so. He blesses the fact that the U.S. spends as much money on weapons as the rest of the world combined. U.S. imperialism, it appears, is God's will, according to the American religion. Barack Obama had a plan. He knew that the only way a black man could possibly stand a chance of becoming president of the United States was to pledge allegiance to the national white historical narrative, or religion. The big lie that says God wanted all those Indians dead and Africans enslaved for some higher purpose that will be worked out sometime in that sweet by and by. Very few blacks buy into the ridiculous white lie. But Barack Obama thought that a combination of his rich backers on Wall Street and the near universal support among blacks would allow him to safely walk a thin line between the competing white and black fires and brimstones of totally opposite narratives on the history and nature of the United States. The two stories cannot possibly be reconciled. One is true and the other is a lie. Now Obama is caught in between, the mumbling man. Does Barack Obama really want to engage in a dialogue on the facts of race in America? Of course not. That was never his plan. A real dialogue means solving real problems, problems of unearned white privilege and power. What else is there to talk about? What other change is worth having? 1 million black men and women are in prison at any given moment. We have already done hundreds of studies on why African Americans are incarcerated in such huge numbers. We don't need a dialogue about this great injustice. We need our sisters and brothers set free. That's the only conversation I think is worth having with Barack Obama, his supporters, or his detractors. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
For more information, visit www.blackagendareport.com. Welcome back to Uprising. California janitors are back on the streets organizing as part of a statewide effort to win a new contract with higher wages, access to health care, and more. More than 1,000 janitors with SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign will march and rally in Westwood today. They are part of a movement of 20,000 union janitors across California whose contracts are set to expire in April. According to the Economic Policy Institute, currently California janitors would have to work for 112 hours a week to earn enough hourly wages to support a family of four. Many janitors spend about 90% of their income on rent alone, while others have no access to health care at all. The Justice for Janitors 2008 California Contract Campaign is the janitor union's largest statewide mobilization effort in history. The janitors will be wearing purple shirts and carrying signs, banners, mops, and brooms on their march through West Los Angeles today at 12 noon. Joining me in studio this morning, Rafael Lieb. He is an organizer with SEIU. Welcome to Uprising, Rafael.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And also with us is Rebecca Vasquez. She works at Century Plaza Towers in Century City, and she's one of the workers who will be on the march today. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
So let me start first with you, Rebecca. Tell our listeners a little bit about the struggle over the current contract. What is it exactly that you and other workers are asking for?
I'm going to translate this question into Spanish. Si nos puede decir un poco de esta lucha que estamos haciendo ahora, ¿cuáles son las cosas que a ustedes y los otros trabajadores, cuáles son las cosas que le quieren, que quieren ganar?
Okay. Hoy por estar hoy aquí, lo que nosotros, los janitors, vamos a luchar contra la comunidad acerca de un nuevo salario, una aseguranza familiar, porque hay muchas personas realmente que no tienen la aseguranza familiar y es lo que necesitamos para la comunidad, no para nosotros los janitors, sino la comunidad. En general, la necesidad que tenemos, que haya unos salarios dignos, unas viviendas dignas.
So, it's not just the janitors who need better wages and benefits. It's our entire community. So we're standing up today, not just for ourselves, but on behalf of our entire community to make sure that we have good jobs that give us the kind of wages that we need to afford dignified housing and the kind of seguro médico, healthcare benefits that we need in order to live with healthy families.
Rafael, give our listeners a little bit of background of the Justice for Janitors campaign. If they're not familiar, this is a campaign that was very inspiring. It's a movement that was very inspiring, particularly several years ago when it became very high profile. I believe it was downtown L.A. in particular that people heard of janitors organizing.
That's right. There's actually a movie that came out about that. The strike of 2000 was probably the biggest event in labor history in Los Angeles at that point. But Justice for Janitors actually goes back a lot further. The campaign really began in earnest in 1990. There was, at that time, an attack by the police against marching janitors in Century City. And A lot of the janitors, like Rebecca, still remember that very vividly. One person even died. Several women lost who were pregnant lost their babies. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the beginning of the Justice for Janitors campaign. Leading up to 2000 was the biggest mobilization of janitors at that time. And in 2000, people were on strike for 3 weeks and won an incredible victory for the first time ever. Going forward from then in 2003, people won family health insurance for the first time. And today we're hoping to extend those benefits not just to janitors in Los Angeles, but region-wide across all of Southern California.
And Rebecca, tell our listeners what you experienced in 2000.
¿Puede decir al público lo que fue su propia experiencia en el año 2000?
Okay, mi propia experiencia fue que luchamos para las divisiones que hay, que son área 1, área 2, área 3, para lograr a las áreas 2, 3, tener su salario digno, principalmente su seguro médico.
So, what we fought for in 2000, more than anything, was to bring outlying areas of the city up to the same standards that we have in Century City and downtown L.A. For us, the most important thing was our health insurance, making sure that people had family coverage.
What were the marches like? What was that victory like?
¿Cómo fueron las marchas? ¿Cómo fue la victoria?
Muy duras, porque teníamos que andar desde la madrugada hasta la tarde, sin comer, sin ver a nuestros hijos. Yo cargaba a mi hijo, en ese tiempo tenía 3 años, y lo tenía que cargar conmigo, yendo a las marchas, caminando, sin desayunar, sin comer. Y ahora, ayer, él me decía, recuérdame cómo fue tu huelga en el 2000. Y yo ayer tuve que sacar fotos, estarle contando lo que pasó en el 2000.
It was difficult. We marched all day from the early morning till very late in the afternoon without resting, without eating anything. At that time, my son was only 3 years old, and I carried him with me throughout the entire march. Just yesterday, he was asking me, Mom, tell me about the march. Tell me about the strike in 2000. And I took out all my old photos and showed him.
So let's talk about what's happening now in California, particularly this afternoon with the local struggle, but also all across California. There are, I understand, a number of contracts that are expiring in April. But how serious is this struggle in 2008 compared to what happened in 2000? Presumably, you're working on top of work that has already been done over the last several years, Rafael.
I think that the struggle that we're facing today is probably going to be the most difficult one ever for janitors.
Worse today?
Well, looking at the situation at the economy right now, it's very difficult. And obviously the hardest hit are the people who are most vulnerable in our community, and janitors represent a large percentage of that population. So while we'd like to build on past victories, the most important thing right now is to bring up standards for all of Southern California and make sure that in our communities, people have jobs that really let them live with dignity and with the kind of health care that their families need in order to survive.
So where are the, you know, what's the current situation with the struggle? Obviously, you're not anywhere at any point near a strike yet, but do you think that it could lead to that? Do you think you could see a repeat of what happened in 2000, Rebecca?
¿Crees que vamos a necesitar hacer una huelga?
Okay, de mi experiencia, no te puedo decir si queremos ir a huelga o no queremos ir a huelga. Lo que necesitamos que vea la comunidad, la necesidad que tenemos hoy en vista por toda la inflación que está subiendo todo, y lo que necesitamos unos salarios dignos, no nomás por ser janitor, sino porque nosotros somos la comunidad. No por ser janitor, yo necesito ganar más, no. La comunidad, necesitamos unos salarios y principalmente el seguro médico.
So, I can't tell you if the janitors want to go on strike or not. What I can tell you is that as members of the community, we'd like for the rest of the community to understand the needs that we have. We need jobs that provide dignified salaries. We need health care. And we understand that those are needs of our entire community, and we hope for the support of the community in winning those things.
Do you think most Los Angelinos understand the struggles that are facing, particularly janitorial workers?
¿Crees que la mayoría de la gente en Los Ángeles entiende cuál es la lucha, cuáles son los problemas que los janitors y otros trabajadores enfrentan diario?
Sí, sí, porque lo estamos viendo en la inflación de todo lo que está subiendo. No porque nosotros somos janitor, necesitamos el aumento, no, sino realmente toda la comunidad sabe que tenemos la necesidad.
Yes, definitely. I think everyone in our community sees the kind of inflation that's going on, the cost of living that continues to rise. And I think they understand very well what the needs are and what needs to be done.
So tell us about the march that's happening, Rafael, today at noon.
Well, we expect at least 1,000 janitors to come. We're going to be meeting at 12 noon at the park on the corner of Wilshire and Federal. And we'd like to invite everyone and anyone in the community to come out and support us and march together with us down Wilshire.
And again, that's today at 12 noon on the corner of Wilshire and Federal, and you're asking people to wear purple.
If they have a purple shirt, please bring it. You're more than welcome.
And what do you what's the next step, Rafael, by the way, in the contract negotiations? You know, as you said, this could be a very, very serious fight given the state of the economy. What is the next step in terms of the bargaining itself?
Well, bargaining has been going on for most of this month. Our bargaining team is actually going to be at the table today, and we hope that negotiations continue to go well. We hope to continue making progress in negotiations. In the meantime, we'll be marching in the street. We have further actions planned, and obviously, while no one really wants to go on strike, we understand that we have to be prepared for anything that might come.
Well, I want to wish the two of you the best of luck in your struggles. And is there information online that people can find out?
Yes, definitely. If you go to www.seiulocal1877.org, that's one word, seiulocal1877.org. There should be more information about the campaign as well as upcoming events.
That's seiulocal1877.org. My guests have been Rafael Lieb, an organizer with SEIU, and Rebecca Vasquez. She works at Century Plaza Towers in Century City. Thank you both so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Uprising, and after this radical day in history, we will find out about how LA's homeless women are still struggling for their rights. Stay tuned.
Join us at 9 a.m. this Sunday, March the 30th, for the Tibet Connection, a special report on the recent events in Tibet and world reaction, an eyewitness account of the protests in Lhasa. Exiled Tibetan monks attempt to walk hundreds of miles from India to Tibet. Sound images of Dharamsala, the Dalai Lama's backyard, plus Pema Chodron about moving from fear to fearlessness. That's Sunday, March the 30th at 9 a.m. here on KPFK.
Hi, I'm Lila Garrett. Monday morning at 7 on Connect the Dots, we will speak with three great women. Fran Pavli, who is running for State Senate in the 24th District, Mary Pallant, who is running for Congress in the 23rd Congressional District, and Jody Evans, co-founder and co-director of Code Pink. Three great women whom we know you will enjoy. That's Monday morning at 7 on Connect the Dots.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 28th in 1860, the Battle of Wareka began. This battle was part of the First Taranaki War, which was a land conflict that broke out between the indigenous Maori people and the British settlers in New Zealand. Although the British were badly defeated in this war, this victory for the Maori was only a small part of the larger New Zealand land wars, in which huge areas of land were stolen from the Maori. A treaty signed back in 1840 had guaranteed Maori tribes undisturbed possession of their lands, but the British had more military power and obviously more greed. You know their MO, only honor a treaty while it's convenient for you. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it.
Welcome back to Uprising. Since 2001, the Downtown Women's Action Coalition has organized annual community-based research projects aimed at assessing the needs of homeless and low-income women in downtown L.A. Growing Needs and Shrinking Opportunities is the latest annual report, surveying nearly 200 women. The Downtown Women's Action Coalition has found through its research dire housing problems, domestic and sexual assault, and failing health statistics for women living in the Skid Row, Central City East community in 2007. Of those surveyed, 62% had been homeless for at least 1 year, while over half reported physical health problems last year. A clear majority of women reported a need for community services, but because of the lack of such resources, nearly 40% of women reported being solicited for sexual favors in exchange for housing, protection, and money. The DWAC report will be officially released at a Downtown Women's Summit this weekend. My guests are Deborah Burton and Fabiola Sandoval. They're both with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition. Welcome to Uprising, Deborah and Fabiola.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us today. Deborah, I'd like to start with you. I gave some of the very broad details of what you found in your survey, but you've been doing this survey, your organization has been doing this survey annually for a number of years now. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how the survey has been progressing? What have the results been? Have you seen any changes between previous years and what's happened lately?
Yes, I have. In our community, we have we have a lot of residents who have been waiting for a long time to access affordable housing. Some changes have been available for the resident, for the ladies in our community, but there have been some changes added to the worst because of different policies that have been put in place prohibiting or restricting some of our community residents to access the affordable housing in our community.
Such as what? What sort of?
The Alexander is a residential hotel which is located on 5th Street and Spring. It has been housing for a lot of our community residents for a long, long time. But then there was this developer that came in that said he was going to create a affordable housing development at this hotel. And he wasn't going to displace any residents from this hotel. Well, as a result of illegal evictions, bad management, harassment, a lot of our community residents have been evicted from this hotel. So a lot of the residents in our community just can't afford to live in this hotel because of the affordable housing plan that he created, brought to our community, and has displaced so many people.
So that has resulted in an even greater number of women on the streets now?
Women's and the whole community, because a lot of our community members have a pass. And with this new affordable housing plan, it restricts, if you have a criminal pass, it restricts you. If you don't earn enough money, it restricts you from accessing the housing that this developer put in.
So you even though it's supposed to be affordable housing, you're still supposed to have a minimum income.
A minimum income. But that minimum income is not accessible. Like, say, for instance, you're on GR, which is $221 a month. You can't pay $500 a month, only getting $221 a month. If you have a criminal history for drug sales, it restricts you because of policies that have been put in place. It restricts you from accessing that housing, housing asset. If the developer or the owner or the manager says that you are a nuisance, that also restricts you from accessing that housing.
Let's talk a little bit about the women on Skid Row. What are the major demographics, Fabiola, if you can tell our listeners? What's the racial breakdown? What are homeless women in Skid Row in terms of age, racial breakdown, ability, et cetera, and what is their condition?
Okay, yes. The women surveyed, I'll be speaking about the women surveyed. The age range is between 18 to 82 years old. The majority of women are, well, 44% are African-American women, 20% non-Hispanic white, and 16% Latina. So predominantly they are women of color that are in the downtown Central City East community.
And what about also just, you know, where they come from? What are their backgrounds? What are their histories?
There is this belief that there are people coming in droves into the downtown community from outside cities or including out of state. But our findings have shown that the majority are from neighboring city, the unincorporated city of L.A., or the county of L.A. So there are individuals from
Los Angeles.
Are
people here from Los Angeles. They're not just, you know, being attracted to Skid Row from outside of Southern California.
Yes.
So let's talk about some of the main problems. So women need resources like healthcare, like housing, like some of all of the major needs that women have in general. And these resources are not available to them in some of the ways that you described, Deborah. So how, you know, what access do they have? What recourse do they have for these sorts of very important things?
Well, there are a number of immediate short-term shelters, but again, like Debbie mentioned, there are long waiting lists. So there are extreme conditions in downtown. There are many, many obstacles, and a lot of the recourse, I would say, would be organizing for your own self or your life in community with other individuals. And I know that sounds like it's almost something, how can you do that when you're missing the basics of housing stability, when you're being harassed almost daily by the police, when you've probably gone through a devastation because you've lost custody of your children. But it's not like there's the political will in the downtown community, or I would say in general, in our society, to help those that are at the very, very bottom.
What are some of the health challenges, Deborah, facing women? I understand that a large percentage of them are disabled. What are some of the health challenges that they face?
The health challenges is accessing the services that's needed. If you're in a wheelchair, then it's difficult for you to go to the doctor, so you would have to call someone, either a family member, or there's an access trust truck that comes and pick you up to take you to services outside of the community if that's what is needed for you.
And I understand that over 30% or almost more than a third of these women are physically disabled?
Yes, that's true.
So how do they get around? You know, what sort of help do they have in getting to the hospital?
Well, a lot of them have, say, for instance, that you can't get out of your room, then there's a Angel's food that comes in and serves you your lunch and breakfast. But then there are neighboring, say, for instance, you have home care that can come in and help you with keeping your room clean, helping you to get your medicine if you have to get if you're diabetic and you need to get your shots.
But do most of these women have that kind of help?
Some of them have it, but then there is this thing with some of the access for the in-home care worker to come in and administer the services that you need. Some residential hotels or some hotels some of our residents are being denied these services. So some of our community residents and the ladies have to just suffer and rely on your neighbors, rely on the friends and families.
What about the incidence of drug and alcohol abuse among women? I understand in the survey there were more than a third responded of your respondents reported drug or alcohol abuse. And, you know, is this something that a lot of the women are suffering without much help? And, you know, how does it make them vulnerable as well, being on the streets and being, in these temporary housing units?
The vulnerability lies with the LAPD. Because many of our community residents are homeless and still in the active disease of addiction, resources is not being offered to them where it's needed. Instead of, if say for instance a lady is in the disease of addiction, she gets caught with a small amount of drugs or alcohol on her, instead of she's homeless, so she's vulnerable to being on the street. Instead of services being offered to her that the voters said that you do not get recovery in jail, services is what they need at LAPD. It's not arresting on the use of it, but the possession of it. And that is another linkage that is affecting our community, because if you get caught for sales, you do your time, you come out, you cannot access food stamps, you cannot access some of the housing program that is in our community. So it's like a vicious circle. You can't get housing, you can't get food stamps, so you got to survive. So you do what you have to do. You sleep on the street, and health problems set up because it gets cold at night. I mean, we do have a rainy season. So, you know, your health goes down, your mental issues that you're dealing with is constantly growing, because, I mean, I can't imagine how hard it is to live on the streets. I have lived in a shelter, but living and sleeping on the street on a daily basis, it's difficult.
So we talked about physical disability and physical mm-hmm. health issues. What about the mental health issues?
Yes.
Fabiola?
The majority of women that were surveyed did report having been affected by mental illness. I would say about 60, almost 67%.
That's two-thirds.
Yes.
Wow.
And what it comes down to a lot of times is stable housing is the best mental health treatment out there. You know, combined with, of course, community support and knowing that there's people that you care about not that far away, and that you have some sort of way of sustaining yourself. So I think all those things play a role.
What about women with children? How are women in Skid Row who have children dealing with that, and also how are children affected?
There are, I think the numbers were 40% of women are mothers of children under the age of 18, and unfortunately the vast majority of them have lost custody of their kids.
So they're living without their children?
Yes.
And what about cases where the women have their children with them? What sort of support do they have, and how vulnerable are they?
There are a number, but again, there's few resources, major needs, few resources. There are a number of emergency shelters that provide housing for families. And, of course, that's a huge risk if you are a mother to a child under the age of 18 or living in the streets. That in itself is a risk of you losing your child.
I'm speaking with Fabiola Sandoval and Deborah Burton. They are both with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition. We're talking about the results of a survey of homeless women in downtown LA Skid Row area. Let's talk specifically about how women in particular are especially vulnerable to sexual abuse being on the streets. Fabiola or Deborah, can you talk about how women are preyed upon?
I mean, it's devastating, not only as a community resident, but as a woman being not knowing who to trust, you can be safe, feel safe in. Mm-hmm. The expectations of ladies in our community has been preyed on in a lot of areas. Some of it is the harassment you get when you move into a new place, the harassment that you get if you have to slip on the street, the expectations that we have to endure, because if you want to sleep in my room, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. If you want to eat, you should do this. If I don't think that you're speaking to me or you're looking at me the right way, you have to endure with this. That plays on your self-esteem. That plays on your how much the need, how strong the need is for these housing, food, friendship, protection. All those things play a major role in surviving in our community.
And your survey revealed that 44.7% of women, nearly half of them, experienced sexual assault during this past year of all the 200 women surveyed. So basically, these are women who are being expected to perform sexual favors in addition, in exchange for housing, for money, for just protection to be out on the streets.
Or to live in a community, yes.
How is law enforcement handling this, and do they even address this issue of how women are sexually vulnerable?
Law enforcement, the shame, the fear for a woman to come and say, well, I have been arrested or I have been assaulted, and not to be believed. And then the treatment that you get, you've been raped twice, because the treatment that LAPD gives the victim is just as devastating as the rape itself.
Yeah. So what needs to happen now? You know, you've been doing the survey, your organization has been doing the survey for several years. What specific recommendations are you making to the city, to law enforcement, and to the community in general to address the needs of women, homeless women in downtown LA?
Did you want to take that?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to make a clarification. It is the third survey. It is not an annual survey. The Downtown Women's Action Coalition does engage in several community-based projects, but it is our third survey. Mm-hmm. And the official release of the survey will be today. Today is our Women's Summit at 12 o'clock from 12 to 3. So anyone that would love to join us, please feel free to come on by on Main and 5th Streets today. So one of the main things, of course, that we feel to address, because it's a multi-pronged issue, the violence coming from all these different mm-hmm. places, is housing first, you know, emerging as an overwhelming need, then community responses to violence and supportive responses to violence in different programs in the area. Mm-hmm. So not only from actual structures that exist, but also within community members to undo the normalized violence that a lot of us have normalized within our life and sort of expect it.
So the summit is happening today, starting at 12 noon, you said?
Yes.
And that's going to be at 456 South Main Street. There's going to be a panel discussion. There will be a keynote address. For more information, is there a website?
www.cangress.org.
CANGRESS.ORG. Deborah Burton and Fabiola Sandoval, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And we've been discussing the Downtown Women's Action Coalition survey of homeless women. Before I end the show today, I'd like to announce that there's going to be a local demonstration related to the first story that we covered this morning about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. There's going to be a protest in L.A. today at 5 p.m. at the U.S. Federal Courthouse at 312 North Spring Street. That's today at 5 p.m. at the U.S. Federal Courthouse, protesting the decision to not grant Mumia Abu-Jamal a new trial yesterday by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Again, that's 312 North Spring Street at 5 p.m. And for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote the early American feminist Lucretia Mott, who once said, "The world has never yet seen a truly great and virtuous nation, because in the degradation of women, the very fountains of life are poisoned at their source." That's Lucretia Mott, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and have a wonderful weekend.